And welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, Managing Editor of News at WCAI. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times, Cape Cod Online. Hello, George.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Joshua Balling will call in from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner will join us. And Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times also will be on the phone. Let's start right now with George Brennan, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We heard from them. They've rejected a bid to expand the nuclear evacuation zones across with they're talking about all of their nuclear reactors. But of course, here in the Cape, there's been a lot of concern about Plymouth and the reactor there and whether people on the Cape will be able to get away if there was some sort of release or emergency there.
That's right. There's been a lot of talk here, but across the country, people who live near nuclear power plants have become concerned, of course, in the post-Fukushima era. And there was a petition that was put forth to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and supported by 37 environmental groups from across the country, including the Cape Downwinders here on Cape Cod. And the NRC is saying, no, we're not going to expand the zone. Right now, it's 10 miles around a nuclear power plant. Interestingly, you know, that doesn't even cover, well, it covers all of Plymouth, mm-hmm. but basically anything around Plymouth isn't covered. Duxbury, a little bit, but nothing on Cape Cod. And obviously, we're downwind from that plant, and there's a lot of concern. What's going to happen if something happens there? How do people get off of Cape Cod? We're mm-hmm. not part of the emergency planning zone now. This would have, had they adopted it, would have put us within the planning zone. At least part of Cape Cod would have been part of it. But that's not to be. Mm-hmm. It's not the first time they've been asked to do this. And it's not the first time they've rejected it.
It's hard to see the downside to creating a plan for an evacuation in case there was something that went wrong. We remember with Fukushima, within days of that accident, the NRC was saying they ought to expand their zone. If you're an American, get outside of a 50-mile radius. But they weren't willing to expand. Maybe it's money. Maybe it's expensive to do that type of planning. I don't know.
It's got to come down to money,
sure.
right? The industry, you know, has its share of lobbyists who, you know, go to Washington and say that they don't want these zones expanded. You know, incidentally, this week, this past week, the Barnstable County Commissioners also joined the chorus of people all over Cape Cod calling for the Plymouth plant's shutdown. And,
right.
You know, this seems to be a weekly thing where some group somewhere on Cape Cod is saying, you know, something needs to be done about Pilgrim. County commissioners now join all 15 of the towns on Cape Cod who have voted in some form or fashion to say something needs to be done here.
Let's talk about pills and heroin abuse. We've discussed this many times over the recent years. The Cape Cod Times has done a lot of reporting about the abuse of opiates, prescription painkillers, and the direct relationship between that type of abuse and heroin. And so we've heard from the governor. He's banned a new type of opiate, and there's some backlash to that.
That's right. Our reporter, Casey Myers, has been all over this, as you said. This is the painkiller Zohydro ER. And
people who are concerned about addiction
yes.
are worried that this particular type of pill is so powerful.
Right.
It's going to even make the addiction problems worse, right?
Right. So the governor came out, and he came up with all these things. He's putting money towards supporting substance abuse treatment. And one of the things he did was he banned this particular drug. And in doing so, the manufacturer, of course, is upset.
Mm-hmm.
And they filed suit as a result of that, saying that the governor overstepped his bounds. Now, KC talked to a number of people who say this is within the purview of the governor to say, you know, he doesn't support what the FDA is doing here. And they point to some AIDS drugs that were available early on in that particular epidemic at the time. And the state of California introduced a drug And they were allowed to do that as long as it didn't cross state lines.
Right.
And we'll have to wait and see how the court case turns out. But right now, the governor is holding firm. And the FDA also weighed in and said that the governor also overstepped his bounds.
The FDA doesn't want states making decisions about what drugs can and cannot be sold in a particular state, just like the FDA doesn't want Congress weighing in on that as well. But my understanding was that it was a subcommittee that actually recommended that the FDA not approve this drug, overwhelmingly recommended, but the FDA went ahead anyway. And everything I read from the reporting, both from Casey and in the Associated Press, seems to indicate that the state's on pretty firm ground here. You can say no, but most states don't because they're not typically set up to regulate different prescription drugs.
We should say, too, that Massachusetts isn't alone here. You know, we have Vermont who's weighed in and said they're placing strict requirements on how these can be prescribed. And Ohio is also weighing in here. So there are other places that are taking a look at this and, you know, trying to figure out what to do about this, which has really become an epidemic nationwide.
It absolutely has. And there was actually a discussion, I think it was last night, among police and doctors. A lot of folks say that people are becoming addicted to these pills after they've been prescribed in a very legal way. And then people do what's called doctor shopping, go to different doctors, get different scripts for different painkillers, and then you're able to sustain your addiction. So what was the discussion between the police and doctors?
Well, the police were saying, and I think some of the doctors who were there were recognizing that they have a responsibility here, that people were being overprescribed. There was one anecdote about a doctor who had overprescribed to the extent that he had to be fired by this particular medical association here on Cape Cod as a result. And another person, there was another anecdote in the story about a woman who had come into a particular office and, you know, she appeared to need one of these pain relief medications. But when they checked it out, she had already been prescribed 72 different times other places. So, you know, but this one doctor finally said no. And, you know, the police and the doctors got together last night and they're talking about what they need to do in order to help out here. And, you know, they're really the point of contact for a lot of people, and, you know, who are looking for these drugs.
They're in a tough situation. If someone is in pain, people with cancer, why shouldn't they have access to these drugs? Certain people, you're not really so much concerned about addiction. You're concerned about them relieving their pain. So it's a tough line to walk. But one thing that's helping out, I think, is this new database that they're coming up with where doctors are now able or about able to go and check a patient and see where they're getting. How many other prescriptions do they have for painkillers? They can see if that doctor shopping is going on, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yep, and that seems to be progress. I wasn't quite clear when that's going to be up and running completely, but it seems to be coming on soon. And might as well stick with the addiction issue. There was a story about the Penikese Island Treatment Program, and that is off not far here from here in Woods Hole. It's an island not too far from Woods Hole, and there's been treatments going on there in the past, but it's been closed for a few years.
That's right. It's been closed for quite a few years now, but it's back on the board. And this targets treatment of teenage boys in particular and goes after, you know, obviously addiction can come at any time. And in this case, they're trying to help out teenagers. It's a 9-bed facility that will operate here close, as you said, to Woods Hole. It had been closed since 2011. They're getting it back up and running. It took a while now. It took about a year longer than they had hoped. But in the meantime, they've been running a treatment facility out of a place up in New Hampshire. And they're going to transfer some of those patients down here to Penikese Island. It's a short-term program. It's about 120 days, and you know, this was staggering to me. It caters to cash-paying clients, and the cost is over $90,000 for this treatment. But obviously, if you need it, you need it. And
parents are desperate. They're desperate to save their children from what they've seen has killed other kids. So if you have that cash, I could see, yeah, okay, if this might work, let's. And I know I've done stories about people, parents who looked towards Outward Bound programs, hoping this would be it, this would save them. And unfortunately, oftentimes it takes a couple different stints in treatment for it to take, or sometimes it doesn't ever take.
Yeah, one of the interesting things I thought about this particular treatment program is it not only gives them some treatment, but it gets them interested in some things. Like there's a boathouse there, and these particular boys will be taught boat building and nautical programs. So, you know, maybe it gives them something else to look at and look forward to.
Expand their horizon, see more of the world than what they're kind of trapped in right now.
Absolutely.
The story this morning that you did, George, about Sandwich's largest taxpayer going to be paying less. And so, of course, the rest of it will have to come from residents.
That's right. This is the Canal Power Plant. We all see it when we cross the Sagamore Bridge. You can't miss it. It's big. It's green.
And it's smoking.
And it's been there for, you know, 50 years. You know, and that's part of the reason that the taxes are going down for that particular plant is that it's been there a while, and it's taxed based on personal property rather than the real estate like our homes are. That would be like the generators inside and the other compressors and the other equipment is what it's taxed on, and that depreciates like your car. As soon as you drive your car off the lot, it depreciates in value. Well, the same with this. You know, they use it and use it and use it, and it depreciates in value.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, you know, the town had to negotiate with them and say what it's worth. The town did an appraisal or had a firm do an appraisal, and it's valued at $137.5 million in the first year of this four-year agreement. That's down from $254 million just 8 years ago. Hmm. So you can see how much it's dropped. Even saying all that, this particular power plant will still be the largest taxpayer in town at over $2 million a year. And so it's still very much a benefit overall to the town of Sandwich in terms of taxes.
People, of course, are concerned about emissions from that plant. But how do we know how often it's running, how often it's actually up generating electricity versus how often it's kind of just waiting to see if it needs to be cranked up to meet demand?
They won't give us specific days, neither the utility or the grid. ISO New England would tell us exactly how many times it's used, but it is only used during peak periods when it's very hot or very cold. Of course, we've had a cold winter, so it's probably been used a few more times this winter than it was the previous winter, but it's still not a lot of the time. It's really in the mold of being a backup at this point, and it will be until 2018, which is the term of the agreement that the town reached with them. Now, the town does have some hope that at some point they'll change how they generate their electricity there from the dirty oil that they use now to natural gas. And if that were to happen, it would be a boon to the town because all of a sudden they'll have new generators there, which will be they'll be able to tax at a higher rate.
Mm.
So that's a few years down the road. That's the silver lining, so to speak.
Yeah.
But for right now, you know, it's depreciating in value. It's not being used as much. And the bottom line is they're going to pay less in taxes.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, is going to join us. We're going to talk about the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup, where you can catch up on all the top news stories of the week here locally on the Cape Islands and the coast. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about big news in town. Lots of people are talking about the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge, waiting for this big management plan that's been in the work for years, and here it is. And what's the reaction?
Yeah, it's caused quite a buzz in town, as you can imagine. This plan for management of the 8,000-acre refuge, which is on the southern tip of Chatham. It's a 15-year management plan. A lot of it focuses on protection of wildlife, particularly migratory birds like plovers and terns, which are the refuge's main mission. But the plan has a bigger impact than that. There's an impact on the community that's really got people talking. A couple of those major recommendations that are causing a stir include an assertion by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife that coastal land accretion law allows them to annex 717 acres of South Beach, basically from the 2013 inlet south to where that land, Barrier Beach, connects to South Monomoy Island. It's a large area. It's almost a tenth of the area of the existing refuge, and although it's a pretty inaccessible barrier beach at this point, mostly home to a lot of seals, essentially. Its western shore, the inner beach there, it has some very productive shellfish areas, which will now, according to this plan, fall under the jurisdiction of the refuge. And shellfishing is a major aspect of this plan. When it was first proposed almost 15 years ago, there was a threat that commercial shellfishing within the refuge boundaries would be banned because much of that area is a federally designated wilderness area where commercial activity isn't allowed. The town did a number of scientific studies, both independently and in conjunction with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and basically they concluded that general harvesting of clams is compatible with the refuge. So the plan does allow clamming, but only traditional hand harvesting. No machines can be used, no carts, which some fishermen use down there to haul the shellfish. Scallop fishing will be allowed, but there are no dredging allowed. The plan also bans harvesting of mussels, which and continues a long-standing ban on horseshoe crabs. There's quite a few other recommendations in this plan, including banning a lot of recreational activities such as grilling, kite flying, kite boarding, kite sailing within the refuge boundaries, not just on the islands, but also on the Morris Island headquarters area, as well as within the western boundary of the refuge, which is includes quite a bit of area in Nantucket Sound. They're also planning, proposing actually to charge for parking at the refuge headquarters, which they've never done before. And also there's a proposal to establish an off-refuge visitor center, preferably in downtown Chatham if they can find the space. Now, town officials, as well as shell fishermen, waterways people here in town are a bit concerned about a lot of these proposals, especially the taking of the South Beach land and the implications to shellfishing. But there haven't been a lot of specific comments coming our way yet, since the plan was just released midweek, and it's pretty voluminous. It's over 1,000 pages. There's going to be a 60-day comment period, which started Thursday. The Fish and Wildlife Service is planning to hold a couple open houses April 24th, and May 21st, and a full public hearing on May 29th. Now, copies of the plan, if you care to read it, are available at the Eldridge Library, and they can also be downloaded from the Monomoy Refuge website. There's an executive summary that's about 16 pages, which summarizes everything. It's a little easier to digest than going through the entire plan. So, again, this is something we're going to be following over the next few weeks. It's something we've been waiting for a long time, and it certainly had the impact that we expected it would.
A lot of times when the federal government comes into a community with a plan like this, there's some concern that the community really won't have much of a say. Sometimes there'll be small changes made. Is there any veto power, any local control here at all, or is this pretty much going to go how the federal government wants it to go?
Well, the Fish and Wildlife people say that they really want to hear public input on this, which I assume means from both members of the public and town officials, that they will consider comments when they revise the plan into a final document. But essentially, you know, there's probably not going to be a lot of major changes to this. They've pretty much covered their tracks. They essentially, especially with the taking of South Beach, that's not even a recommendation. That's something they're asserting is in effect right now. So town officials, I think they're probably consulting with town council now to find out what kind of options they have there. But, you know, and it's interesting because a lot of this is bringing up amongst some old-timers here the initial taking of Monomoy Island by the federal government back in 1944, which just sort of happened as a fait accompli, and there was a lot of resentment back then because at the time, the island had camps on it. It was used basically for recreation. It was a wide open area. But it's going to be interesting to see how people react at the public hearings and what kind of comments are submitted and how Fish and Wildlife reacts to that.
Tim, just briefly here, I know we've talked about the Mitchell River Bridge in the past. Now there's a construction start date.
Sure. This is another longstanding project. But just to be quick about this, the bridge, which people say is possibly the last wooden drawbridge in the country. Bids were open for construction last month, and there's a June 1st start date. Now, this is going to mean that the bridge is going to be closed. Bridge Street will be inaccessible from a couple areas, and this could the contracts include a 2.5-year construction period. Town officials hope they can get the construction started earlier and have it go a little quicker than that, because 2.5 years includes 3 full summer seasons. And if, the town wants to limit that as much as they can. The bids were about $1 million higher than expected, $13.8 million, but there's enough money within the federal and state appropriation for this project to incorporate that.
And remind me, will it be a wooden bridge or is it a combination?
It's a combination. Yeah. State officials said a wooden drawbridge would not meet standards for safety, as well as for longevity for a new bridge. So it's going to be steel and concrete under structure in the water and just above the water, and the top of the bridge will be mostly wood with a wooden deck as it is now. The only part of the top of the bridge that won't be wood is the draw span, which will be steel and concrete. Federal and state officials think that this compromise is a good one. It'll look similar to what's there now. It won't look exactly like that, but it'll last over 75 years, which is their design criteria.
Excellent. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. You can follow Tim and the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Thank you, Tim. Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Thanks, John.
Okay. Talk to you next week. Let's stick with the phones. Joshua Balling is calling in. He's the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. He's director of the digital content at the paper as well. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
You've been spending a lot of time at town meeting. I was following your tweets over the weekend. Tell me, hit the highlights for us.
Yeah, we provided blanket coverage of town meeting all 7.5 hours on Saturday. Nantucket did a one-day town meeting this year, something they tried 2 years ago as well. And turnout was pretty light, about 455 people at the peak time right before lunch, which is not that great, about 5% of the town's 8,500 registered voters. The high points, I'd say, voters took no action, actually, on a proposal that would have allowed for a couple of large-size stores over 20,000 square feet, actually, in the neighborhood of 40,000 square feet along Old South Road. That's part of a development planned by Phil Paston and Richmond Great Point Development out there. He's going to bring those back to town meeting when he says he has some more information for voters, who the tenants might be, what the actual size and look of the buildings are going to be. So no movement there. Voters also voted to send a petition up to the State House to change the makeup of the Historic District Commission. It's been a controversial group out here, our Architectural Review Board, to make part of that group appointed and part elected. The state legislature would have to sign off on that before it happens. They also sent a petition up to the legislature to exempt the island from some of the state funeral home regulations, hopefully making it easier for a funeral business to open on the island. The Lewis Funeral Home closed in December after 135 years of business on the island, and there is no current funeral home or funeral services on the island. They have to come from the other side when someone passes away, over from the mainland, obviously. So
sure.
Quite a bit of work there, and wrapped up in just about 7.5 hours.
Okay, and there's an upcoming election on the island?
There is. Tuesday is our annual town election. There are two contested races, one for the Board of Selectmen, with incumbents Rick Atherton and Bob DaCosta facing challengers Clifford Williams and Adam Reed. And in the land bank race, challengers Gene Casey Miller and Bruce Perry will be squaring off against incumbent John Stackpole. And the polls are open at Nantucket High School on Tuesday from 7 in the morning until 8 at night.
And George Brennan and I were George Brennan of the Cape Cod Times, and I were just discussing some of the heroin and opioid problems here on the Cape, and that also extends to the islands, doesn't it?
Nantucket is not immune from those same problems. It hasn't been for as long as they've been problems on the mainland. There've been problems on Nantucket as well, but just as it appears to be addiction to opioids and heroin, other opiates rearing its ugly head again around the country. Even same thing on Nantucket, and we've got some additional challenges out here as well. The healthcare officials, law enforcement officials say that particularly with narcotics like heroin and the opioids, the treatment is not as readily available out here. There aren't any treatment centers, detox centers, and once if an addict does get clean, goes to the mainland to a treatment center, detoxes, comes back to the island, there aren't any halfway houses. The support system really isn't here, despite the best efforts of the healthcare providers and others out here, and often fall back into the same patterns. Our Dr. Tim Lepre at Nantucket Cottage Hospital says that there's probably a drug-related emergency room visit at the hospital every couple of weeks. He can recall at least 4 overdose fatalities on the island in the last 10 years, and while not fatal, at least 3 opioid or opiate-related overdoses were reported in a 48-hour period out here over a weekend a couple months ago. So it's definitely a problem out here. I don't know that it's necessarily growing, but it is a problem that Nantucket is not immune from, just like anywhere else.
There is no equivalent to, like, an Alcoholics Anonymous over there for people who are addicted to
There
opiates?
Are. We do have Narcotics Anonymous, uh-huh. Alcoholics Anonymous groups, support groups, but in terms of halfway houses that addicts who have gone through detox, gone through the whole problem, can transition back into, I guess, everyday society is the right word for it, they don't exist here. The actual detox centers don't exist here. The hospital, the doctors here do their best. Even the police department quite often works with those that they know who are struggling with addiction and tries to get them the help. But the physical support, the island's not big enough, perhaps, to have those kind of things, so it becomes that much harder for someone struggling with addiction to get clean and stay clean.
I gotcha. Okay, Josh. Josh Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror and director of the digital content at the paper. You can follow Josh on Twitter at jballingim. Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Sally Rose is on the phone. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Sally.
Hello, Sean. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for joining us today. Provincetown town meeting, we were talking about the proposal to ban plastic bags out there. I've been curious, how did that discussion go down and what was the result?
Well, it was interesting and received a fair amount of discussion. It ended up getting indefinitely postponed, however. Proposal was by the Recycling and Renewable Energy Committee. And voters didn't feel that it was written clearly enough. There were too many questions surrounding it. I think it probably will come back again, maybe at the fall town meeting, maybe at the next spring one. We'll see.
This was a 3 full nights of
it
town
meeting. Right. And they had 44 articles to go over that spread out over those 3 nights.
Any trouble getting a quorum?
No, didn't seem to be. But voters did start out pretty feisty right on Monday.
Oh.
And they decided out of the gate to cut the salaries that were budgeted for 2 empty top positions in town. That's the town manager and police chief. Cut the town manager position from 149, the budget line, 149,000 to 120,000. And then the police chief's from 134,000 to 110,000. Those are the positions that are currently empty now, and there's a search on for the new town manager. The search for the police chief will wait until a new town manager is in place. So I think the selectmen were a little nervous about having that happen, but voters decided that's what they wanted.
That was was that a voter petition that came forward?
Yes. Yes, actually, it was a FinCom, Finance Committee, proposal.
And did some people...
Actually, it was amendment to the budget.
Were some people concerned that that might make it more difficult to find a quality town manager, an experienced town manager?
Yeah. Yes, indeed they were, several of the selectmen especially, and a couple members of the town manager search committee. also were. I guess they decided that if they ultimately, if they needed to, they could dig up some money elsewhere in the budget to supplement that.
Oh, I see. Okay. Any other highlights you'd like to bring up?
Well, there was, let's see, affordable housing got a boost of the share of funds from the Community Preservation Act. Voters also put the kibosh on the proposed study that would have looked into whether a new larger police station could be built on that existing site. They ultimately decided that it's not worth spending the $45,000 on because most believe that that location can't house a larger station and still adhere to the town's zoning bylaws. They also approved, as most of the towns will be doing or have already done, the floodplain overlay district. And that amends the town zoning bylaw, so it conforms with the county's new FEMA flood designations. And then there was also a controversial soil excavation proposal, and that would have allowed the removal of a very large amount, 2,000 cubic yards of earth. That's versus the currently allowed 750 cubic yards. And it would have allowed it without seeking a site plan review or a special permit. And that failed after a rather contentious debate. And just as a comparison, an average house needs about 200 to 300 cubic yards excavated.
Oh.
So that ended up being an interesting discussion.
Okay. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. We all love town meeting time. Thank you very much, Sally. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay. And with me here in the studio is George Brennan. He's with the Cape Cod Times. He's a reporter there, covers the town of Sandwich, among other things. And we have a story out of Sandwich. We've been talking about Town Neck, which has been losing sand for quite some time. There's a threat to the homes there. They've been trying to craft a plan.
That's right. This has been going on for years and years. Every day that goes by and every storm that goes by, the beach gets more ravaged. They're getting close to filing permits for a beach restoration plan. It was engineered by the Woods Hole Group. Kirk Bosma is the coastal engineer who put it together. He says once this plan goes into place, it will replenish about a one-mile stretch of beach. It will add about 200 feet of beachfront, which is pretty impressive, and it will add to the dunes about 145,000 square feet on the dunes and fill in some of the gaps that have been made over the years. What stands in the way of that, of course, is funding.
Sure.
The town has a couple of applications in that they're really hoping to receive. They should hear sometime within the next week on one of them for $5 million from the federal government, and that's for damage done by Superstorm Sandy and one of the brutal storms we had last winter. I think the National Weather Service or Weather Channel or whatever called it Nemo.
Right.
And so that particular storm really caused a lot of damage to the beach. And they put in for this $5 million grant, and they're looking to use community preservation money to match that with $1.2 million from the town. If they get that money and a $4.8 million in disaster relief from FEMA, they'll have enough money to put into effect this restoration plan.
And do they think really this is the solution, this plan will correct the wrongs?
Well, what it will do is this particular plan will restore the beach for about 7 to 10 years.
Gotcha.
I mean, it's not a permanent fix for the beach. There is no real permanent fix to the beach. But the jetties for the Cape Cod Canal are what are sand starving the beach. They block sand from going into the canal and clogging up that. But at the same time, the sand is kept on the Scusset Beach side and isn't able to go to Town Neck. We got a bird's eye view of that this week. Myself and Merrilee Cassidy went up in a small plane and took a look. She took pictures, photographs that are online and in the newspaper. And you can just really see. I mean, you could see huge pockets of sandbars on the Scusset side, and the dunes just ripped away on the Town Neck side.
Yeah.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has finally agreed to a study. The town's been pushing for this for nearly a decade, and it's called the Section 111 study. This particular study would determine once and for all if those jetties are what's causing the problem, as most engineers, coastal engineers, agree it is, and the federal government would then have some liability in helping the town fund a more permanent solution by pumping sand around the canal or underneath from the Scusset side to the town next side to more naturally replenish the sand.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Nelson Siegelman, the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times, is going to join us. He's going to give us the rundown on the town meetings on the island. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in the Woods Hole studio is George Brennan, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone is Nelson Siegelman, managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Thanks for standing by there.
Sure.
Town meetings Tuesday night. There were three of them, right?
We had three: Edgartown, West Tisbury, and Oak Bluffs.
And tell us, what were some of the highlights?
Well, really, in Edgartown, there wasn't a lot in the way of big questions, although Edgartown voters agreed to spend money on regional projects that include an effort to move the Gayhead Lighthouse back from the eroding cliff. And they agreed with a proposal for all-island fertilizer regulations. I think it's worth noting that less than 6% of the town's eligible voters turned out. That's always interesting. And they decided on more than $30 million in spending. In West Tisbury, the big question was dredging, or starting the process for dredging Mill Pond. It's a very scenic pond in town, and there's been some talk about perhaps allowing the brook that feeds that pond to revert to its natural state. So that was a pretty big debate. And in fact, the folks who want to keep looking at whether or not dredging is the right course prevailed. So the first steps towards dredging were postponed for now, and we'll see what happens with that. In Oak Bluffs, there are a number of big spending questions there. A new town hall and a new fire station were on the town meeting floor. Those were both approved, but this is sort of breaking news. Yesterday at the ballot, voters approved spending on the fire station, but they turned down spending on the new town hall, and these were all close votes. Voters thinking carefully about how they spend their money. And also, I think I should note that Michael Santoro and Walter Vail, two selectmen up for re-election, were in fact elected to three-year terms again. So that was a big contest there. And Planning Board Chairman John Bradford, longtime incumbent, he was defeated by Ewell Hopkins. So there are a number of races in town as well, and those all took place yesterday.
Okay, folks can get a rundown at the Martha's Vineyard Times website or pick up the paper to hear more about town meeting and the town election. Nelson Siegelman is the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Nelson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
George Brennan is here in the studio with me in Woods Hole. George is a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And George, let's talk about the Dennis Yarmouth School District. There was a vote. It was Dennis that voted, right? Or was it Yarmouth?
It was Yarmouth. And, you know, some people think baseball is a harbinger of spring. Some people think Robbins. I look at DY schools and the fight over money at DY. This seems to be a perennial issue.
Yes.
And this week on Monday, the town meeting followed the advice of selectmen, and they underfunded the school budget by $278,000. Now, that's out of a $28.1 million budget. Just how that shortfall will be made up isn't quite clear yet. It could either come from cutting the budget, Dennis voters pitching in more money than their town's required to vote in, or there could be a special town meeting in Yarmouth to come up with the additional funding somewhere down the line. But for right now, it's the perennial issue. One of the towns decides to vote less, and there'll be some wrangling.
It was hard to even figure out how they came up with that particular number. To just stop short, it seems like maybe what you seem to be implying is they're setting up a fight, and as we've seen in the past.
Yeah, and I think it eventually becomes a frustration for some of the other departments, which in the past have had to cut their own budgets to make up for a larger school budget than was anticipated. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see how this all shakes out in the coming weeks.
Okay, let's stick with schools a little bit, but let's move over to Sandwich, where they're talking about shifting around some of the grade levels.
That's right. This is all caused by the fact that declining enrollment in town, and the Henry T. Wing School, which is the town's oldest school, needs quite a bit of repairs in order to stay open. They estimate anywhere from $30 to $50 million to get that school back into shape. And with the declining enrollment, it just doesn't – it's not cost effective. They don't really need the room. And so the superintendent came up with this idea to move 7th and 8th graders into the high school. And phase two of that is what to do with the two remaining elementary schools. They're K-8 schools now. The superintendent would prefer to have pre-kindergarten through 2nd grade at Forestdale School, and then grades 3 through 6 at Oak Ridge School. Mm-hmm. And but there's a groundswell in town that wants to keep those schools K-6 schools and redistrict and have, you know, two separate schools, each of them housing K-6 students.
So the concern isn't so much about getting the 7th and 8th graders over to the high school, which we – I know in Mashpee that was a real concern. Some people see that age range just to be too much. It's really about keeping those elementary school kids together.
Well, they're going back a year ago, there was concern about that move of 7th and 8th graders into the high school. But the superintendent assured parents that it would be a school within a school. Mm-hmm. It's going to be what he's dubbed the STEM Academy. And so parents are excited about the curriculum there,
right?
What they'll be offering the students. So that's kind of quelled their fears. You know, those might become more evident as it becomes closer and people start to think my 7th grader is going to school with a senior in high school.
Right.
But, you know, this particular issue is, you know, part of it stems from the fact that a school is closing and it's a beloved school and all change is difficult.
Sure.
So the parents started a Facebook page. It gathered a lot of people fast, 254 people within a day or two of that launching.
So is the decision imminent?
Well, it had been scheduled for April 30th, the school committee to vote. But breaking news is that the superintendent has decided to hold off at least until mid-May. He wants to gather more information about it. And I should have a story about that that'll be posted online later today and in tomorrow's newspaper.
Okay. There was a story about limited funding for seal rescue. Seal rescue is something that happens quite often around here, but this is on Nantucket, right?
That's right. On Nantucket, there's no funding anymore for this, apparently, and it's a real issue out there. Of course, the seal population has come back strongly.
Sure. Yeah.
And so the New England Aquarium, which at one time was rehabbing seals, doesn't even do it anymore because the seal population has come back so strongly. At least that's what the spokesman says in this story. And they've refocused their attention to other species that have stranding issues, sea turtles.
Oh, right.
You know, which we've had a lot of stories about here on Cape Cod, and of course on the islands, they have the same issues there with strandings, and so there are some people who are trying to put a team together on Nantucket in order to, you know, deal with these strandings and you know, help out the seal population, but the funding, as always, is an issue, and there isn't any at this point for seals.
Interesting story in the paper this week about an entrepreneur who you saw a need for people to have marijuana seeds to grow their own. And so that's the business he's in right now. And it was interesting. He doesn't seem to be getting hassled by anyone. And it sounds like he's got a robust business there.
Well, immediately when I saw the headline, I thought, is this legal?
Right.
And apparently it is. You know, he's, like you said, he's not getting any issues from local police or state police. He's been doing this for quite a while now. He started back in November when medical marijuana was legalized.
Yeah.
As you know, before these dispensaries open, people are allowed to grow their own medical marijuana, and if they are within too large of a distance from one of the dispensaries, they're allowed to grow their own as well. And so that's where he sees his business. And he figured that he would only start selling a very small amount of these, but within the first month or the second month, he was already selling 100 packs of these seeds. And as you said, it has been a robust business for him. Each one of these, or 14, there's a packet,
mm-hmm.
14 seeds inside, they sell for $75.
Mm. Well, it sounds like if you need medicinal marijuana, that growing it yourself, if you can manage it, would probably be the way to go. They're still trying to decide how much they're going to charge for the medicinal marijuana from the dispensaries, and they seem to be basing it on what the street value is and all these crazy formulas, which is hard to understand if you're trying to make a medicine available for people who are sick.
But once the dispensaries are open, my understanding is that if it's within, I think it's 50 miles, I don't know for a fact right now, but I think it's within that mm-hmm. that range, that if there's one that close by, you have to buy from that dispensary.
I'm not surprised. Okay, real quick, Christy Myhos. We know Christy. He used to own several little convenience stores on the Cape, and we also know him as a former candidate for governor, and he was in court.
That's right. He has reached an agreement with the district attorney's office, and as a result, he was put on pretrial probation, resulting from an assault and battery charge that was brought against him. It had to do with his ex-wife, mm-hmm. and he's been ordered to stay away from her, and he's also been ordered to seek mental health evaluation and go to probation. And interestingly, he's not allowed to talk about this publicly, which...
They took away his First Amendment rights, did they?
That's correct, and which must be difficult for Christy Myhos, because in my experience with him over the years, one of the things he's always enjoyed doing is talking to reporters.
Okay, I really want to get to this story about a Route 6 bridge has been named. It will be dedicated and named after a Navy SEAL who was killed in action.
That's right. It's going to be named after Kevin Houston. He was killed in Afghanistan in 2011, and this was signed into law by Governor Deval Patrick. It's going to happen in the next few months. The bridge will be dedicated by the Department of Transportation. An interesting aspect of this story, I think, is that his mother, who now lives in Virginia, mm-hmm. would like to get back here for a ceremonial signing by the governor, and maybe even see the dedication of this bridge. And she's opened a PayPal account to help her with the costs. I don't know what her situation is, but obviously she can't pay to do it herself. And I'm sure there's some good people here on Cape Cod who would like to see this Navy SEAL's mom here for this event.
I'm sure there are. And we're not going to get to it right now, but there's a very nice story in the paper today in the Cape Cod Times about a message in a bottle. And I would encourage people to check that out on the website, or better yet, pick up the paper and take a look at what's happening in your community. I want to thank George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Join me here in our Woods Hole studio. Thanks, George.
Thank you, Sean.
You can follow George on Twitter at GPB227. And thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Sally Rose from the Provincetown Banner, and of course Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.